question. So in our order, I'm not sure if you've been here when we've been doing the regular topic. Maybe you have. In our order, we've been discussing all the mitzvahs of the Torah one by one in order. So in the order we've been going through, we're up to a bunch of mitzvahs pertaining to court procedures in a beis din. How does the Jewish court function? And the I think that there is one fundamental understanding of a Jewish court system, which I think will then pertain to many of the mitzvahs discussed. So I want to start with introducing, what's our perspective on the Jewish court system? I mean, just to give the basics, there's three different types of Jewish courts. There's the three-man court, there's the court of 20, the 23-man court, and the 70 or 71-man court. Those are the three different courts. So the three-man court has the ability to judge monetary cases. For capital cases or cases we're going to give lashes, they need a 23-man court. And then they have the high court, the Sanhedrin, which is the Supreme Court. They're the ones who do the legislation. Any case which is undecided goes to them. Any law which is in doubt goes to them to decide. And they have the final word on the Jewish court. That's the Jewish Supreme Court, Sanhedrin. The way we understand the Jewish court system, I believe, is the following. There is a Mishnah in Pirkei Avos. It says in Pirkei Avos, Rabbi Shmuel relates, Al tidon yechidi. A person should never judge alone. She'inyan don yechidi el echad. Because the only judge who can judge alone is the one with the capital L, is God, the one and only. The Al Tamar, don't say kablu daiti. Don't say accept my opinion. So this a judge should never say to the other judge, accept my opinion. She'in reshayin v'ata. Because the other judges have the permission to rule as they wish, and you can't coerce them into ruling as you wish. That's what Rabbi Shmuel tells us in Pirkei Avos. So the perspective on a Jewish court, I believe, is based on this mission as the following. That technically an expert judge, maybe you have a judge who is the wisest, the most just, the most compassionate judge in the entire world. He knows the Torah backwards and forwards, he knows all the laws, he's experienced. He shouldn't judge alone. Halachically, there are certain times where he'd be allowed to judge alone. A few exceptions to the rule, he's allowed to judge alone certain times. But either way, he's not supposed to judge alone. We don't recommend it. Why? Because as human beings, everyone, by definition, has their own perspective. They see things their own way. As unbiased as you want to be, as knowledgeable as you are, but still, everyone's going to be coming from their own background, their own slants on things, own life experiences, and they can't necessarily see every single side of the case. So as smart as you are, as well-meaning as you are, we can trust that one human being is able to judge a case in a just manner, an unbiased manner, even as hard as they're trying, as knowledgeable as they may be, as experienced as they may be. The idea of a beis din is that you have a lot of great minds together, and we hope that each human being, from their own perspective, has a different outlook on the case, and putting those minds together to come out with the truth. That's the idea of a beis din. It says that Rabbi Shmuel tells us that the only one who could judge alone is God, because since God is the one with the capital O, God is all-encompassing. God sees all, feels all, hears all, knows all, sees all perspectives. So God could judge alone because he sees it from every single side of the case and he knows what the truth is. But as human beings, as much as we try, we can never see every single perspective on a case. And therefore, we can never judge alone. The God who is Echad, he is the one and only. He can judge alone because he sees every single perspective of it. So then it relates that the judge should not coerce the other judges to rule like him. It's exactly the point. Even if you're the expert, you know the laws through and through. It's not up to you to coerce another judge to rule like you, because maybe he sees things differently. And maybe, as much as you know, maybe you're wrong. Maybe your perspective, based on your life experiences and based on who you are and how you see things, maybe this case happens to be wrong. Because we can never trust that you have the right perspective on it.
But wait a minute. If you say you need a minimum of three, let's say it's a monetary issue, so you have three
yes.
judges.
Right.
Is not each one arguing his point of view with the others? In which case you are essentially trying to... I mean, how do you... The three judges sit, then what do they do? Just vote?
No, they do deliberate. They certainly deliberate.
The deliberation in itself, isn't
right.
that essentially trying to coerce?
But to coercion in the sense that I'm the most knowledgeable and experienced judge, just listen to me. That type of coercion.
No, I can understand.
Yeah.
That's haughty. I mean, you wouldn't say that.
Right.
Say, we're all equal here. Here's my point of view, and here's what I think, and here's why I think it should be this way. By saying that, am I not trying to convince you two other judges here, that I'm right.
Well, when you give your opinion, then the others either take your opinion or they don't.
Right. But beyond that, you can argue the case. You can argue the points. There's deliberation, certainly. You know, just like you might have them in a jury in American court. There's deliberation, but ultimately, so if I say guilty, you say innocent. You shouldn't tell me, but I'm the senior judge here, and I know the best, and you're dead wrong.
I'm
smarter than you. I've been on the court for the past 50 years, and I studied smarter backwards and forwards, so just listen to me anyways. That you shouldn't say. Because even though maybe in terms of the objective facts you think you're right, and you think that I'm totally biased and ignorant and swayed, I might be wrong.
I'm so glad to see someone swearing I think I've had one bagel in the last 3.5 years since I was
really?
I
cool.
eat, they make, I don't know if you ever seen thin.
This thing, the sticks?
No.
Oh, thin bagels, I've seen those, yeah.
That and roll, that's right.
Right.
You'll
forgive
my.
I'm happy ordering. I encourage people to order food there. We don't sit here and take up their space. We should order their food. A lot of people come in, they're not hungry, they already ate lunch. I'm very glad you ordered.
You know what people eat? I eat people.
Right. It's a little past lunchtime.
Exactly.
Come here. I know. That's my fault, but I can't be here earlier.
Yeah.
No, but I encourage people to buy food and eat because they're generous enough to give us their space, and their facilities here. So that's my perspective. So the basis is supposed to be everybody together with their own perspective and their own human mind and their own understanding of the Torah and their own understanding of the case. Together, they'll bang their heads together, and then we go through the majority rules at that point. There is the rule of majority rules, which I want to discuss more now. So the... I think that's the general perspective on a Beis Din, that as smart as every judge is on their own right, no human being can be trusted to know the truth inside and out in the case. They see from their own personal bias, even though they don't mean to be biased, everyone is biased in their own ways. So therefore, they have to work together, and at that point, they vote the majority rules.
Are there three people who get when they give a get?
No, it depends on how they do it, but if it's the husband giving it, you don't need it. If it's done through a messenger, you need a Beis Din.
Oh.
But if the husband gives directly, you don't need a Beis Din there. So,
okay.
Different, yeah. No, because a get doesn't require, only requires witnesses, but not a Beis Din, typically.
Oh, that's witnesses.
Yeah, you need witnesses, right. You need two witnesses on a get.
Two witnesses.
Yeah. No, in Rabbi Annemer's lifetime, he used to, the Gittin and Simcha Mitzvah in his office in the yeshiva.
Oh.
He used to call in people from the yeshiva. Commonly to come in and witness the get or be sit on a Beis Din as part of the get. So, I guess for better or for worse, I had a lot of experience with it in his lifetime. Now they don't do it in the Shiva anymore. But so the verse that I want to discuss today, it's in Parshas Mishpatim, and the verse says, it's one verse that has a lot of different points about the court system. It says, Mosisa Shema, really two verses we'll do. Mosisa Shema Shav. One should not literally carry a false piece of knowledge, I guess would be the best translation. One should not accept a false testimony. We can understand it that way. I'll discuss it more in length later, maybe next week. Al Tashas Yadchim Rasha, do not place your hand with a wicked person to become a lying witness. Do not follow the majority to do bad. One should not answer in order to avoid controversy. I'll explain all these because every single one is vague. And we should follow the majority. So I'm going to start with the last one first. I think that's an important perspective. Following the majority. The rule in a Beis Din typically is following the majority. We will discuss that for a capital case, the majority of two. For other cases, you need a majority of one, but for a capital case, because of the nature of the case, needs a majority of two. Majority of one, we would not execute based on a majority of one in a capital case. But this concept of majority rules, it implies both in court cases and applies in legislation. If the Sanhedrin is voting to create new laws, and they're making new decrees upon the Jewish people, then you also go with majority rules. If you're deciding halacha, it's majority rules. In a Beis Din, so if they're voting on a case, guilty, innocent, a majority rules. So obviously, majority rules is a concept which both sides have to be in a valid opinion, meaning that somebody who's totally ignorant, we don't say, well, since nowadays, unfortunately, 90% of Jews in America may not be observant Jews or knowledgeable Jews. So the fact 90% of people say that it's okay to eat pork, we're not going to say majority rules, now we can eat pork. I mean, obviously, that's not how we apply majority rules. Majority rules means you have people who are knowledgeable, sincere, God-fearing, and in their opinion, this is right or this is wrong. So now they have a vote now. Once they have that vote, so now there's a kinds of majority rules.
Different from judges.
The difference amongst the judges.
No, you're saying people. Different. We're not talking about judges now. You're talking about the general population. Is that correct?
Right. Yeah. That's what I'm talking about right now.
Right. Let's make sure.
Yeah. That's what I meant there. Because the rule majority rules applies in many situations in Torah law and halacha. But the majority we're discussing means the majority of people who are knowledgeable of Torah and God fearing and sincere, not someone who may be ignorant of Torah knowledge. Because that's not an opinion that should be counted in this type of vote. The majority rule certainly applies in a Beis Din amongst the judges, and applies amongst those who are legislating laws. The understanding of this, on the one hand, it's obvious we have to be able to rule in some way in a court. Unanimous decision is not going to be practical in most situations. But the Sefer HaChinuch says another interesting point, which is that without the rule of majority rules, the Torah would be in shambles, because everybody would do as he sees fit. I think that this law should apply here, so I'm going to follow it that way. You think that way. He thinks that way. Well, if there's no way for us to reconcile the difference and create one law for the entire Jewish people, so then there's going to be 1,000 different Torahs, 1,000 different rule books for Jews. It'll be chaos. That's the problem. So majority rules. God gave us a tool which God says, if the majority votes, that's going to be what I want you to do. That's the halacha. A fascinating point, which we need to discuss more in length, whether or not that was the original intent of the Torah. Maybe God, when he said something, meant X. But the Beis Din, for whatever reason, voted Y. Again, a God-fearing, knowledgeable Beis Din voted Y. So God says, now I want Y is now correct. I want Y to happen now. Right? Because God says, we need to have this rule majority rules for there to be one Torah, or else it's going to be anarchy, it's going to be chaos. So whatever the Beis Din decides, that's what I want, God says. And you have a lot of examples in the Gemara of that point, where even though the most fascinating example is in the case where you have God himself performing miracles to support one rabbi, but the majority of rabbis ruled against him. So the halacha was like the majority of rabbis. Even though God's performing miracles to support, you know, Rabbi X, we follow
that story.
You know that story.
Story.
Yeah, it's a very famous story, but it paints a very important picture, which is that, you know, the tool of a Beis Din, a majority rules, is such an important tool in Judaism. Even if God himself comes in and I'm going to perform a miracle to show you that guy's right, we still say it, but that's not evidence in a Beis Din. Miracles cannot be submitted as evidence in a Beis Din.
Is that what they said? The law is not in heaven, the Torah is not
in heaven. Yeah, exactly. The Torah is not in heaven. The Torah is given over to the hands of man. Right. So that's a very fascinating application of this rule of majority rules. So when we have majority rules, that means that the responsibility now is upon the Beis Din to do their best. If I follow the Beis Din's rule, then it's not my responsibility. I'm doing the right thing. If the Beis Din makes mistakes, that's their responsibility. And if they discover they made a mistake, so there's a special sacrifice they would bring. There's something called a parla helam davar, which was a special sacrifice brought on behalf of the Beis Din when they ruled incorrectly on certain important cases, and people followed their ruling, and then they were found out to be correct. So they'd have to bring a special sacrifice to atone for that, because it's their responsibility at this point. It wasn't my responsibility following them, it was theirs for ruling in the wrong way. The
question I would ask is, how do you determine if you're saying what the correct way is the majority rule of Beth Din?
Right.
Beth Din, I guess.
Yeah.
And that's, by definition, is what's correct. So how can you say now they've made a mistake?
Because sometimes you can find authoritative sources which might go against what they said. If they were to rule, for instance, it's really obvious. You know, let's say that we know that tefillin are supposed to have 4 different paragraphs inside. If they rule, we're supposed to have 5 paragraphs of tefillin. And then we find evidence, you know, from beforehand that we know that there's only 4. So then that would be say, that's obviously wrong. If we're not talking about a case where there's a trial from, I'm talking about legislation in this context. If they legislate something which we find to be clearly wrong based on tradition, you know, they just made a mistake. They for some reason they missed something that day. So then that's where there's a special sacrifice. There is another mitzvah which we'll discuss much later on in the Torah, but I'll mention it briefly now. It's called a Zakein Mamre. A Zakein Mamre is an elder or a judge, a rabbi, rules in one city, and people in the city tell him that's incorrect. That's not our tradition. So he says, let's go to the court and see. And the court in that city rules he's wrong. He says, and he goes out and he rules again. Finally, they bring it up to the Supreme Court, to Sanhedrin. The Sanhedrin says that you're wrong. You know, that's not the halacha. That's not what our tradition tells us. So if he goes ahead and rules again based on what he thinks, he's put to death, this rabbi. Because even though in his mind it's 100% correct, this is my tradition, my rabbis taught it to me, but the Sanhedrin says, our majority rule says that's not part of the tradition, that's not the halacha, and this rabbi goes against them, he's put to death at that point. Because we have to have a system which keeps Torah unified. So this is how we keep Torah unified, it's based on majority rules. There is a commentary, he's called the Mincha Blula, and he says even further, that you know, God foresaw that at a certain point in history, there would be confusion, there would be dispute, prophecy would be gone, and we would have no way to clarify Jewish law. So you have to set up the system so that the Beis Din is in charge of clarifying Jewish law in this manner. But unfortunately, in our days, we don't even have that system anymore, so now we're really stuck. But at least for many, many years, after the end of prophecy and after the confusion began, there was a Beis Din to resolve the differences. The Sanhedrin carried on after the destruction of the Second Temple for another, I think, 100 years or so. And at that point, the institution was null and void. I think it was around the time of... I'm very bad with dates, but I think it was another century or two after the destruction of the Second Temple, we did have a Sanhedrin. But after that, we were left on our own. So now we don't have any central body that should rule Jewish law, which does lead to a lot of dispute. You know, and nowadays we do see a lot of splintering in Judaism because of that. But ultimately, this system was meant to keep us unified, and it did it for many, many centuries, and we hope to restore the system once again soon. But that's the idea of following of majority rules. Now, I'm going to... One more time here. I'm going to go back now, backwards. That is the very end of this verse that we're discussing. So go back to the beginning of the verse. The first part of the verse says the words, lo sisa shema shav. A person should not bear... I don't want to say false testimony. The word shema means a false... piece of knowledge, or a false, literally shema is a something that you have heard, shema. Do not take in something which is false. Do not hear false ideas. I guess that would be a literal translation. The way this is understood by the commentaries, it's understood in many ways, but one point is that one point which is halachically cited by the Sefer HaChinuch, is that you're not allowed to hear one litigant in court before the other one comes in. So let's say we have a trial set up for today, and one litigant enters into the courtroom. And he starts making his claims. The other guy didn't show up yet. So the Beis Din is not allowed to listen to him yet. Because it's not fair. Because if the other guy was there, it keeps him in check. He'll tell him he's lying, he's wrong, that wasn't how it happened. And they're kind of nervous of one another, and they keep each other in line. If one guy shows up first and starts speaking to me as a judge, and making his claims, without anybody keeping him in check, he can say whatever he wants to say. Nobody's going to stop him. So the halacha is that the judge is not allowed to listen to him until everybody's in court, and he's not. And the halacha is he's not supposed to start speaking. I mean, it's both a warning to the judges and to the person on trial: you may not speak until everybody's present in the courtroom. This idea of do not take in false hearings. The idea is that we are setting him up to lie. Basically, we're giving someone an opportunity to give the judges false claims. That's what we're doing. So you're not allowed to let him speak. That's right. Yeah, right. So the other point is that you're going to create a bias in half the judges if he starts speaking first. Because I believe it's the Rambam points out, Maimonides, that even if you clarify at the end that this guy, when he walked in, was lying, but first impressions mean a lot. If the first impression of the judges was in favor of this guy, so then it's very hard to change first impressions. We all understand that. We all know what a first impression can do for us. Unfortunately, when we meet somebody and we have our first impression of the person, and it makes a big difference on us. So the idea is that you have to make sure everyone's present in court. Now, usually, the person who the halacha is the person who makes the first claim in court is going to be the I guess the plaintiff, we call it in English, the person who's claiming against the other. He makes his first claim in court. I'm not sure what it's like in the American court system, but the plaintiff, I assume it's the same thing. But so once they're both there, the plaintiff now can make his claim. But he has to wait. No one can speak in the court, so everybody shows up. So that's losisa shema shav. And distancing ourselves from lies and fabrication, not only is it wise in a courtroom, but the Sefer HaChinuch points out that you know God is the source of truth, God's the ultimate truth. The rabbis tell us that God's signature is he signs truth, because God is truth through and through. So if we want to emulate God, then we emulate God by doing things which are true. We don't set ourselves up for hearing lies, saying lies, even in a way which you know we don't mean to. So we have to make sure that everything stays really on the straight and narrow. Anything which smells false should be avoided in a courtroom. And in our lives, for sure, you know, beyond the courtroom, you know, we should stay away from things that are sheker, that are false. And if so, then we are emulating God, and God's blessing can rest upon us, the Sefer HaChinuch writes. But if we enter into situations of lies, even unintentionally, we set ourselves up for dishonesty, so then we're not emulating God, and God forbid the blessings do not rest upon us. But as we emulate God in how we act, so then God helps to give us, help us succeed, and gives us His blessings. So that's the idea of Lo Sisa Shema Shav. There's another point which I'm not going to discuss now. Rabbis point out that this is also a warning not to accept Lashon Hara. If somebody comes to tell you a story about someone else, I'm true or false, but it's not your business to be listening to ideas about somebody else. It's a negative reports about another human being. That's going to create that bad impression of the person in your eyes. You didn't see it yourself. You don't know if it's right or wrong. So the rabbis say that the same exact verse which warns the judges to set up the court case in a way which things will be honest and true. So too, that's the same warning to every individual not to accept Lashon Hara. That's what the rabbis say. The next part of the pasuk, next part of the verse explains, Lo al tashis yadcha im rasha, literally do not join hands with a rasha, with a wicked person, li'os ein chamas, to be a dishonest witness, to be a stealing witness. That's the literal translation. So it means simply that you cannot have a sinner testify in court. You know, one of the laws of Jewish court is that the witnesses have to be upstanding Jews. Somebody is known to be a Rasha, known to be a sinner, we cannot trust him testifying in court. Obviously, we understand why he's not trustworthy. If he doesn't fear God, then we can't trust him to tell the truth. There's a reason even in modern courts they swear on the Bible before they give testimony, because you have to show that you're a God-fearing person, and this is under oath, you know, or else we can't trust you in court. Secondly, the Sefer HaChinuch writes that a person who doesn't care about his own personal fate, a sinner is saying, I don't care about my fate. So why do I care about somebody else? If I don't care about my ends and where I'm going, because I'm willing to do what I want to do in life, regardless of God's word, so why would I care about where you're going? So I'll commit and I'll lie about you too. If I want to put you to death, I'll testify that you should be put to death. If I want you to pay money, I'll testify you should pay money. Because I don't care about myself, I should care about you. So it's also, we look at him as an insensitive person. But this is an interesting perspective, because if he doesn't care about himself, why would he care about others? So that's what the Sefer HaChinuch writes. The other commentary, the Sforno, he writes that even if you're convinced that this wicked person is telling the truth in this case, he let's say I was there with him. We were together and we watched a crime happen. And I, you know, he's my friend, even though he's a sinner, he's my friend. And we were watching the crime happen. So I know he's right. I still can't go to court with him and testify, because since his testimony is not admissible in court, at this point, technically, I'm only one witness who's valid, and a Jewish court can only function based on two witnesses. So if you do the math, you know, this guy is disregarded. This guy's disregarded. Now I'm coming into court, and essentially I'm trying to cause the judges to rule based on one witness's testimony. That's invalid in a Jewish court. So what I've done now is something which is unjust. I've stolen money, I put someone to death inappropriately, because it's my fault now, because he's not accepted in court. So that's that's another point made, why you can't join hands with the false witness, even if he's telling the truth here, with a sinner, you can't join hands with a sinner in court. And Rav Shimshon Rafael Hirsch, he writes that this not joining hands with a wicked person in court means, this is a warning to a judge, that a judge should not allow a wicked person to exploit his position. Maybe this person is coming to try to convince the judge to rule in one way. Joining hands with the wicked means that I'm joining hands with you to rule in a certain way in the case. So the judge has to make sure that nobody exploits him. And if somebody, a sinner, comes in to try to exploit the judge and sway him to rule in a certain way, that should be avoided. So that's the idea of not joining hands with a sinner in order to be a witness. The next part of the verse, one more time here, next part of the verse states, We're starting a little early today because the restaurant is closing early today.
Oh, it's closing.
Yeah, so I have to stop a little bit early. There haven't been at 2:15, the rabbi right for us said. So we're trying to stop a little bit the light's going out. So he said we could stay a little bit past 2, but I'm gonna try to end by 2:10. The next part of the verse states, or sorry, the next verse, it states, Lo siyar achrei rabim l'ra'os. Do not follow the majority for bad, for evil. So what's the mean? Don't follow the majority for evil. So halachically, this means that you need a majority of two in a capital case. The Gemara goes through a discussion. On one hand, we have a rule, majority rule, as we discussed earlier. But then it says, don't follow the majority for bad, for evil. So the rabbis teach us, well, the idea is that a simple majority can rule in most cases. But you need a majority of two to rule in a capital case. That's what I believe the Mishnah tells us. So the Sefer HaChinuch writes, it seems obvious. Why is that? Because we have a level of compassion in capital cases to human life. If a person is executed, you can't bring them back to life again. If money is transferred, you can reverse the case if it's wrong. If the human being is executed, you can never reverse that. It's over. God is... What?
And with the person that he killed.
Okay, but we don't know if he killed somebody. I mean, we're trying to judge him right now in court. Okay. So, in general, we have very lenient rules in terms of capital punishment. It takes a lot to execute a person in a Jewish court. So one point is you need a majority of two rather than a majority of one. Hashem is called Rav Chesed. He's abundant in kindness. We're supposed to emulate Hashem. So we have to show this extra compassion to this person who is up for execution. We have to be extra compassionate to him, go beyond the letter of the law, which usually is majority rules. The Torah tells you, you're going one more, and you need a majority of two to kill him. And loss of life is so serious, you can't play around with it. So that's the concept Sefer HaChinuch writes. He writes additionally a very interesting point. He says, he goes off on a little tangent in another discussion. So let me give you an analogy. Why is it that we are so nervous in a capital case to execute somebody? And if so, then why is there capital punishment at all?
Right.
So he says, I'll give you an analogy. He says, let's say that somebody has a lot of children. He says 100 children. He has 100 children. And his children start their own city. That's what he says. So now, in the city, you want people to treat each other nicely. You want them to get along. You want them to be honest and just. You want businesses to be able to act in an honest way and not compete in illegitimate ways. So you have to enforce some laws. These are all your children, and you love them. You don't want to punish your children. You don't want to make your children be whipped or, God forbid, executed. But if you don't have such laws in place, there's anarchy in the city. People do what they want. So what you do is you have to set up a court system, but you're going to do what you can to get them off the hook if possible, because they're your children. But if the court system isn't in place, it'll be anarchy. That's what he says. So we are all God's children. And God says, I want my world to function in a productive way, in an honest way, in a just way, in a way which is efficient, in a way which is people can live and thrive. So if there's no laws, no court system, so then we're in big trouble. People do what they want, there'll be no repercussions for it, there'll be anarchy. But once I'm setting up the court system, I'm not so quick to punish, because you're my children, and I love you, and I want to make sure that you're given the benefit of the doubt, that you're given a little bit of leeway, especially when it comes to capital punishment. So when you find so many leniencies in a court, certainly vis-a-vis capital punishment, that's how we should view it. That God says that you're my children, I have to have extra compassion, I want to have extra compassion on you, but I still need to have the system in place, because that serves as a deterrent so people follow the laws and society functions as it's supposed to function. So that's the analogy that the Sefer HaChinuch writes. The other point made, that why you need a majority of two in a capital case, is made by the commentator, the Ralbag. He says a very interesting thing. He says that if there's a majority of one, so then at times it'll be viewed that one person had to be killed. Right? Let's say, the Beis Din, they voted, and it's half and half, and that one guy's undecided. It's like one guy now votes, okay, execute. So now it's going to be looked at. This guy just killed the guy on trial is being killed by this one extra judge who voted to execute him. So we don't want to have that appearance of one person killing another. So you have to have a majority of two, so it never comes down to that one person. Now, it happens to be, it will come down to that one person, because if one guy votes, if there's a majority of one, still waiting for the judge to vote, you'll still have that same appearance. I don't know how we resolve that problem. But you never want to appear that one person is killing. Which is why I believe that even when in American systems they execute, they don't do it in a way which you can always perceive who was the actual one who killed. And firing squads, I think, were built on that idea. You can't say I killed him, because I had another five guys firing with me.
And somebody had a blank.
Right. So you never know who killed whom. So that's part of the idea.
All five of them killed him.
Or five. Okay, yeah, but it's never, you can't blame me. It could be all
the
five.
The point is that
someone had a blank,
one
then,
blank,
right?
Yeah. Every person can say, I had
the blank. Right, it wasn't
blank.
Me. So we don't want it to be perceived that he killed the criminal. And therefore, you want a majority of one judge being able to execute. Let's see, we have one more point to make here. I don't want to go over time, so maybe we'll stop here for the day. Can't go over time today because of the restaurant.
But isn't the Torah kind of just kind of pretty blatant about the person who...